This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. A note before this segment, this discussion took place on the afternoon of Election Day 2018 before the results came in. And now here's the segment.
All right, everyone, it's Election Day. It's Election Day. I promised that this time I was going to stay up and actually watch all the returns because in 2006, I went to bed by 11 o'clock and I said, all right, it's a wrap. I'm going to bed. And I woke up the next morning and I had to listen to NPR tell me three times that Donald Trump was the president of the United States before I was like, oh, I didn't mishear. So I'm like, I'm watching everything so that I don't wake up feeling like I'm still in a dream.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this,
I have the opposite impulse, Leslie. Like I was so, I'm still traumatized quite honestly by what happened that I'm going to try to watch it, but if it's bad news, it's going to be so distressing. So I don't know. We'll see how I play it.
Yeah. And so, so I mentioned that because so here, Mark and I are having different, you know, reactions or different plans based on our reactions to what happened in 2016. And one of the things that, you know, the media has been impressing upon us over and over and over again is how incredibly polarized the country has become, not that it wasn't polarized before, but it's become seemingly much more polarized, and that politics is now at the center of that polarization process. And so given that, what do we think is going to happen to this country post-election, right? Are we going to just all be like, okay, fine, like those are the results, let's move on and try and be a country again, or what?
Well, I expect not. Like my experience here in the United States, I guess, starts at the end of the Clinton administration. And all I've seen of this country is more and more escalation and sort of more and more norm breaking by Democrats too, right? Not just Republicans, but politics is getting so dirty. And I was reading this great book. I think it's called How Democracies Die. The book's by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Have you guys heard that of that book or read it?
I haven't read it, but I mean, I'm an NPR junkie. I've heard them talk about it.
So it's a fantastic book about, and there's some great parts of the book on norm breaking. And they make a great point that, you know, formal rules can only bring a system so far, a political system so far. You have to have people respect the rules and the spirit of the rules. Otherwise, you get a situation like work to rule in a labor context where everybody's following the law, but only to the letter of the law, and the whole system breaks down because, you know, you can't have any social system work where everybody acts within, you know, as much discretion as they can to maximize their self-interest. Without any, you know, as long as the law, you know, permits it to the letter. And that's what I see happening here. And I would expect that whatever comes up, we're going to see more people trying to undermine our political institutions. You know, we'll find more dirty tricks, more brinksmanship. And I just feel like this is nowhere near the end of this. I don't even think the 2020 election is going to be the end of it.
Well, you know, there's part of me that is actually fairly optimistic about what seems to be this significant increase in voter turnout. I mean, if we're just, you know, looking at early voting results, right? And there's a part of me that's optimistic, that's like, you know what? People who've never voted before might be voting now, and the feeling that they get after having cast their vote, you know what I mean? I think might inspire them to be like, huh, you know what? This is what democracy feels like, right? And this is what it means to be a participant in democracy. But then there's the other side of me that's like, you know, what if all of those people are only voting out of anger, right? And it's like, oh, yeah, you take that, people, right? You know, and so I don't know. I don't know what to think, because I actually also believe that the way in which media actually shapes what the election looks like and also what the electorate looks like might not necessarily be the only side of the story.
What do you mean by that?
I think what the media is telling me is that we are incredibly polarized, everybody's angry, and everyone just wants to win, right? And I don't know, like, I don't know how true that is. Maybe it's because I can't vote, right? That I don't feel that instinctual anger and that wanting to like run out and stick it to the next guy, right? And just, you know, whatever, just vote down the party line, right? As a result, because I just want to win. I don't know. I don't know. It's because of who I am as an individual that I feel like I don't know. That doesn't totally ring true to me. But I don't know what you guys think.
You know, that's an interesting part that Mark, you go. I wanted to say, what do you think about Leslie's point about maybe the news media exaggerating the amount of polarization? Do you think that a lot more Americans are in the middle?
That's definitely a major factor involved in it. Mm-hmm. I think the public's probably like 30, 40, like 30 that have very clear liberal left sensibilities, 30%. Mm-hmm. Conservative right-wing sensibilities, and then a lot of people that are ambivalent in the middle. Media, I don't think it's only because you have opportunists, although they're there too, that are trying to consciously exploit tribal divisions. I think the media is a profit-driven system, and it's gonna sell tribalism because tribalism sells. But I think that's only one of the things going on. I think there's a sort of concatenation of institutional forces that are heightening the polarization. Certainly, we read a lot about what political elites have done in terms of gerrymandering, kind of conscious strategies also to speak to political differences. I think social media inadvertently has contributed to this because, you know, in the old days, I don't mean to sound romantic, but you kind of have to go to the bar and someone, different political persuasion, you're going to drink with them and you're going to kind of like them as people, and it's going to help you transcend your differences and sensibilities. Now people just get into their little political bubbles with each other. And when you're only hearing that and feeling that, and then you have a media system as well as political elites that benefit by exploiting it, it enhances this tremendous tribalism. You add to all of that the very severe, I don't mean to sound so apocalyptic, but very severe political economic problems, climate change, real problems that are existing in the world. They're putting stressors on the core way in which our economic organizations are configured, and you have a kind of dangerous cocktail. So my take on things would be that for better or for worse, in coming years, maybe even decades, politics will be part of the conversation more than in our childhood. You know, as kids, we were like, you don't bring it up. You don't talk about religion. You don't talk about politics. I think those days are gone. We're going to be having more political conversations in coming decades. And I think that's kind of a mixed bag, whether that's good or bad. But I think we need to be aware of it. So I see my mission in part in some of my work, but also my politics, is to try to turn down the temperature.
Well, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting and over the past couple of weeks is that there is one individual in my Facebook feed who is actually actively sending these stories to me. But aside from her, I've been getting these sort of random posts in Facebook, basically, I guess, trying to let me know that there are Black Republicans and that I should consider becoming a Black Republican, which is so crazy to me because, I mean, do people think that Black people don't know that they can be Republican if they want to? I know Black Republicans. Some of them are in my Facebook feed. And it just seemed like this very, very, like, this very, very, like, sort of concerted, targeted effort to kind of exploit, I think, what the people or organizations that are providing me with this information think is some kind of ignorance on my part.
Well, I think it's strategic. I would imagine it's like a form of reassurance marketing. So you're just trying to tap any latent Republican Black Republican who's like, geez, I really don't want to do it. And you're hoping that if they get a mailer that says, you know, buddy, it's all right. Don't worry, you can like Trump.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Like, Black people know that. Like, just like everybody else who wants to be a Trump supporter. They know that, right? Mm-hmm. Or it does, some of them are like, it's not, this isn't about Trump, right? This is about mm-hmm. the Democratic Party taking your vote for granted. Right. So why not? It's like the Trump appeal in 2016, right, to minority voters, except without him in the picture. Right.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that argument, though, Leslie? I know I've heard that argument in the Jewish community that, like, it's good that we are not, that there is ideological diversity because then we're not a point of partisan politics.
Oh, I'm totally for it. Like, let me tell you, I'm a leftist, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not about party for me. It's about what's the message this individual, right? I could see myself voting for a Republican here, an independent there, and a Democrat there, right? Mm-hmm. As long as the message they were giving me about substantive issues that were important to me were like, yeah, you're resonating. Yeah. I do believe that the Democratic Party has taken the Black vote for granted for a very, very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting to me is that people who comment on this act like Black people are stupid and don't know that their vote is being taken for granted, mm-hmm. right? It's just that very often Black voters are saying we're voting for who we think is the lesser of two evils.
The caravan's not resonating with you, Leslie?
No, the caravan is definitely, the caravan is resonating with me in ways that make me very, very, very ashamed of the rhetoric that's going on right now. And the lack of humanity that certain people have when referring to these they're individual stories, right? Mm-hmm. Of people who were suffering back in their countries of origin, right? They're not mm-hmm. just this horde. And I think that by insistently using the word caravan, mm-hmm. I think what it does is it sends out a message that dehumanizes the people who are in there and the reasons why they're coming, right? And treats them like a mob. There's a strategic reason for doing that.
You know, there's one more thing that I wanted to ask you guys about, because I know, of course, our political circumstances have a lot of structural issues, but I do want to talk about television just really quickly. I see it as it's become just a cancerous force. And in some ways, I think Donald Trump is the cable TV news president. Like, so much of the discourse is, trades and just argument. Like, it's just pure argument. Like sophistry too, right? Like, not like substantive policy stuff, but just character arguments and things like that. Do you think that cable TV news in this particular context is a special force, or do you think it's just reflecting, how society is?
Mark?
I think it's both, but it certainly also has its own imperatives. It needs to make money. I mentioned earlier this kind of interface between our tribal nature as well as what the media needs to do to get things that get attention. I had mentioned prior, I think we were discussing that study by John Jost about the tweets that get attention.
Mm-hmm. Are they, yeah.
You know, say the red team's great, blue team sucks, we'll get, people share it all over the place.
Right.
And then these more kind of trade-off political tweets no one pays attention to. So it's a real difficulty. And it also speaks to the larger problem that we confront, really a problem within democracy. Mm-hmm. I think both of you would agree with me on this. We want a world where everybody votes based on policy, mm-hmm. where these are the policies, these are the impacts it's going to have. And yet we live in a world where most people, I would say, this may sound elitist, but I think the lessons of political psychology suggest it. Most people vote based on emotional affinities that they may not even be aware of, and identity groups. So then you need to get candidates. We have to be aware that we need candidates that are going to sort of tap that emotive pool of sentiment. But at the same time, we care deeply about these actual issues. So it's, mm-hmm. it's a tough needle to thread. We want to, and I think we probably all do this in our classes, try to teach critical thinking, try to let people, try to nudge students away from their emotionality and more toward their rationality. But in the meantime, we live in institutions that are money driven, and they're going to continue to sort of, I think, gain traction to the extent that they exploit these psychological tendencies.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.